Good morning, everyone. My name is Daniel Smith. I'm here to chair the session and make sure that those of you know what to do. So presumably you've been in sessions before. You know, once Daryl finishes speaking, you can get up and ask questions. I beg your pardon. You can ask questions at the microphone, and of course you will throughout the whole session be filling in your feedback forms actively online and live. Daryl's going to talk about an actuarial approach to a tax system, which I'm interested to hear, and I'm, of course, like all of us here, we're interested to understand is how he's going to save us money and make sure that we don't pay more tax than people who seemingly earn millions of dollars more than us who pay less tax. Anyway, I don't know where that's what it is. Daryl's a member of PwC's actuarial team and has been there for over 10 years in their sort of accident comp and GI area. The area he specialises in is in the lifetime treatment and care for people who are seriously injured in terms of analysing those liabilities and those risks, and in particularly in relation to the no-fault accident schemes that we have here in Victoria for the TAC and for WorkCover. PwC's team, so not just the actuarial team, but throughout the rest of PwC, have released several papers in terms of policies regarding tax reform in Australia, and Daryl's here to talk not, he told me just before, not on PwC's view. Whilst he's taking some of that material, ultimately his view. So there's lots of little disclaimers here. It's all about Daryl. It's not about PwC. But he's taken basically his view of what he thinks might be interesting for you and might be interesting for the Australian society in terms of tax reform.
Thanks, Daniel. As the saying goes, there are two certainties in life, death and taxes. And as actuaries, we've helped successfully manage some of the risks associated with deaths, in particular around the financial side of things, for many years, and it's really been the foundation of our profession. And I think that there's many learnings we can take from those roots and apply those to the tax system to help it become a little bit more sustainable. As Daniel said, these are my own personal views and not that of PwC. And as part of this discussion, I'm also going to try to avoid talking about specific policies to a large degree. I think everyone's entitled to their own views, and I'm sure everyone in this room will have their own opinions on how specific policies should work. What I'm trying to do is really to talk about a new framework for assessing sustainability. And so there's been a lot of press, it's in the media almost every single day, about whether Australia has a fiscal problem, a debt problem. Do we have one now? Will we have one tomorrow? But there's been one question that's been really burning in my mind, and it's one that's not often talked about, and that is, over the course of their lifetime, does the average Australian pay enough tax in order to fund all the services that they demand from government? And to me, this gets to the heart of what sustainability is, because if you're not meeting this requirement, you're going to fall short of what a sustainable system looks like. This here is my great advantage. It's my blank canvas. I don't have to worry about the political realities, winners and losers from changes in the system. I don't have to worry about ideologies or getting re-elected. And so what I've tried to do is come up with, if we had a blank canvas, a clean slate, how would we start from scratch and come up with a system that is truly sustainable? And then towards the back end of the presentation, I will talk about maybe some steps we can put in place so that we can actually work within the constraints of the reality of today and make some changes going forward. Throughout this presentation, I'm going to go through three key problems that I see with Australia's current tax system and how we measure its effectiveness, and hopefully employ some actuarial techniques and thoughts to make it more sustainable and more transparent. The first problem that I have with the way that the current tax system is measured is we've got this idea of consolidated revenue. For those who don't know, what most governments do is they get revenue from a whole lot of different sources, whether it's your personal income tax, company tax, excises, GST, a whole range of different things. They funnel it into a single pot of consolidated revenue, and out trickles funding across a whole range of different social benefits, whether it's welfare, infrastructure, the public service itself. And whilst this provides a high degree of flexibility, there's many problems with it. For one, I think it having a single pool creates a lack of accountability, and there's no nexus between the taxes people pay and the services they give. And I think that this lack of connection has a bit of a psychological impact as well, with people's reluctance to pay taxes. I think if we could see a bit more of a connection, a bit more of a direct connection, I should say, between the taxes that people actually pay and the services they deliver, we might be able to see a little bit of a change in mindset as well. That's not to say that everyone's going to love paying their taxes, but I do think that we can change the mindset to some degree. And another problem with the current approach is that we get some short-term volatility, particularly in a commodity-based economy. And I think this can sometimes blur what's actually happening at the underlying level as well. So governments often try to portray their financial credibility, especially Australian governments in recent times, by this idea of a cash surplus, essentially that tax receipts in a given year are more than the outgoings, and that makes the system sustainable. I think this view is far too simplistic. Consider if a multi-line insurer operated with this view of its business. It would never fly. In a business context, each product generally has to be self-sustainable and pay its own way, and there's limited and usually well understood cross-subsidies that may occur from time to time. And I think this standard should apply to government spending as well. And I think, therefore, we need more granularity in our approach. And my solution is to have multiple funding pools, to move away from one consolidated revenue pool to somewhere between 2 and 5 pools. It has to be manageable, has to still be flexible, but I think moving to a few more pools will provide that degree of accountability and connection that we're not currently seeing under the approach. So some examples of how this may work, if we were to just take a 2 funding pool scenario, would be we could have recurring expenditure and capital expenditure as 2 separate pools. Or we could look at benefits which are paid to individuals and individual tax collections, as opposed to things which are done in the national interest. And I'm going to pick up on this and sort of run with that approach for the remainder of this presentation, because it's one that I think works quite neatly. So what I've gone and done is look at the 2012-13 financial year, and we can see that benefits that are paid to individuals in that year are in the order of $350 billion. So this covers everything from social welfare, health expenditure, education, childcare, essentially anything that can be traced to a single person. If we then look at what tax collections were from individuals that year, from income tax or other excises, etc., it was in the order of $316 billion. So there's a little bit of a shortfall in terms of from a cash position at least, between what was collected and what was paid out. On the other hand, if we look at expenditure in the national interests, so that might include the public service, defence, communications, transport, expenditure during that year was $154 billion. And tax collections from corporations, trusts and the like was $182 billion. So we actually collected a little bit more from those entities then went into paying the national interest. But they're actually reasonably well aligned, considering that this was never an intentional program. And by taking this approach, what I think we need to do is flip the problem around. So rather than having this input of all the tax collections and seeing how we can allocate them, what we can now start to do is have a discussion around what services do we want individuals to receive and what benefits should they receive, and therefore what tax collections from individuals should come in order to pay for those services. And this is a completely different mindset to the way government works, as I said, where the input is, in a sense, the tax, and the output is what we can afford to spend on different services. It also means we can have a bit more of an educated debate on some policy issues. So One that has been quite topical is whether the company tax rate should be cut from 30%, and in last week's budget there were some changes. Oh. I don't know how that happened. Must be on some automatic timer. But what this analysis actually shows is that if we were to just look at what is paid by corporations, we could actually afford a reasonably substantial reduction in the company tax rate. And we can then have an argument about how Australia compares about other countries, rather than just, well, everyone else's corporate tax rate is lower. We can at least start to say, what do we want these taxes to provide? So it's just more a bit of a considered approach than just copying everyone else. But on the flip side, if we were to do that, this analysis might indicate that we might need to raise taxes that are paid by individuals. So we need to always have a balanced approach. So what are some of the benefits of having multiple funding pools? As I mentioned already, taxpayers will know what they're actually providing. Corporations will know that they're there to fund infrastructure, to fund defence and those sort of projects. And individuals will know that they're there to fund the programs that they want to receive, whether it's the pension or the health service. And I think that that will actually have quite a big psychological impact. We've seen already with the implementation of the National Disability Insurance Scheme that the government was able to increase taxes specifically for that scheme with very little objection. Everyone's tax rate went up by 0.5%, and that went through quite smoothly because they could see the connection between what they were paying for and the outcomes that they were getting. It also means that it's a little clearer to measure some structural deficits. Now, governments do this already, but I think having separate funding pools will make that... doing it again, it will make that even clearer. We can see that, you know, that individuals are paying enough taxes to meet their needs, or that corporations are doing the same thing. And although it's not specific to having multiple funding pools, I do think we need to shift away from just what the cash surplus was in any given year and actually look about what is the bank balance, if you like, that Australia has. Do we have enough money in the pot to pay for some of these infrastructure projects, or do we need to go out and borrow money? Likewise, I showed on the previous slide that in that particular year, outgoings for individual benefits were more than the cash revenue from tax that was collected. And that in and of itself, I don't think is a problem. I don't think the cash position in that year is a problem, provided that that is coming from savings. If Australia had saved additional amounts over the journey, then drawing down on those savings could be part of the plan. And I think that lack of a plan is one of the problems that Australia is currently dealing with. Another benefit is it reduces the risk of over-responsiveness to commodity prices. About 10 years ago, we did see high commodity prices result in ongoing personal income tax cuts. And there's a lot of political reasons behind that, and that's fine. Politicians are entitled to do what they're elected to do. But if we did have separate funding pools and we showed that the funding for individual benefits was not at its requisite level, it just makes it harder for governments then to have that cross-subsidy. That what might have been more pressure on at the time was to use that additional funding that we were getting from high commodity prices and use it to top up any underfunding that we were seeing on individual benefits. And taking this to the next level, you know, maybe what we need to have is that all government projections would use a long-term funding level for commodity prices, and to the extent that prices in a given year are higher or lower, that amount could be saved so that it balances out over the cycle. And this leads me to another sort of idea, which is this idea of recession funds. Again, saving a little bit of money that is there from the national interest pool each year to allow for the fact that a recession is likely to occur maybe once every 10 or 15 years, and we need to make sure that we're putting money away so that we can have stimulus if that's the government's approach at the time. The second problem that I have, and probably my biggest problem, is that of the pay-as-you-go approach. The tax system itself is all about wealth transfers, there's no doubting that. But I've never heard it articulated that part of the wealth transfer that we're aiming to have is that people born in one particular year should transfer their wealth to people born in another year. And the pay-as-you-go system facilitates this unintended wealth transfer, and it doesn't manage demographic or policy shifts over time particularly well. What we see at the moment is that most of us here as workers, we're paying for our parents' and our grandparents' retirement, and when we get to that age, our kids and grandkids will pay for ours. That's the way it's thought to work, and over the cycle it's intended that, you know, you get your turn. But life isn't static. Things are changing all the time. And people are living longer than previous generations, and so what tends to happen is you get a little bit of underfunding, because my retirement is probably going to be longer than my parents' retirement. So in order to facilitate this, what governments have tended to do is rely on a growing population, whether it's through, I don't know why it keeps changing by itself, but it keeps me on my toes. What governments are intending to do is grow the population through higher birth rates or migration and use that bigger pool of workers to fund an increasing pool of older people generally. But what happens when this stops? We've seen in Japan that they're under tremendous financial stress because their dependency ratio has shifted so much. And this stems all the way back to essentially a pay-as-you-go system. And the way I view the current system is it's actually a bit like a Ponzi scheme. We're currently seeing more, we're needing more and more new investors, if you like, workers, to replenish the pot so that you can pay out returns to people who are no longer working. And if that doesn't continue, you're going to run into strife over the long term. And a pay-as-you-go system really facilitates that. The pay-as-you-go system also doesn't really consider long-term impacts of affordability. We heard this morning, you know, already about what the impact of changing the indexation rate on pensions and what that means. And these are long-term questions that an actuary is really well placed to consider, but that governments, you know, they do some work, but, you know, political reality of the day makes it really enticing for them to say over the next 4 or 5 years, the impact is quite small. And even the intergenerational report, which does take a long-term view, it's still essentially snapshots of cash flow projections and how they are comparing relative to GDP, as opposed to actually looking at how different generations are actually utilising the system. So what I've been able to do is, again, using the experience from the 2012-13 year and some research performed by ANU, was to look at what are we spending our money on and where's the money coming from by age? And it actually really surprised me that this needed to be a separate investigation from ANU in order to do this, and that governments really don't have a clear idea of where all their money is actually going. They know that they're spending this much on health, but they're not tracing it back to the individual and looking at what are the individual circumstances, their age and all their other characteristics. And what we're seeing, this picture is not going to surprise anyone. We spend a lot of money when people are younger, particularly on education. We spend a lot of money when they're older, particularly on health and the pension. And in between, we collect a lot of money mainly through income tax while people are working. And so there's a clear mismatch between the timing of tax revenue and tax expenditure when looked at by age. And so putting this together, we end up with this diagram which looks at the net picture. So at younger ages and at older ages, people are net takers from the tax system. And in their working ages, they're typically givers to the tax system. And I don't think that's going to come as a shock to anyone here. What's interesting to me was the quantum of some of these numbers. So while you're working, the average person is contributing about $10,000 more than they're taking from the system. That's not a huge amount of money, and part of that is because not everyone is working during those ages. We've got unemployed people, we've got people in disability support pension as well. So all of that eats into some of the resources. But by the time you get out to age 80, it's in the order of $40,000 a year that you're taking from the system on average. And if we were to take all of that money just from age 65 and later and discount it back to age 65, it turns out that we actually need, as a country, to save in the order of $350,000 per person to fund those ongoing costs as we age. And that's not even taking into account what's happening at younger ages. And in order to do this, that would require, unfortunately, Daniel, you're not going to get a tax cut according to my system, roughly a 23% increase in total tax collections by age. So a very substantial increase. And so, I mean, these numbers, they require a little bit more work, and I'll get to that as well, because some of the information is not all there, and I've had to make many assumptions in order to generate that. But what I'd like to see from a lifetime costing point of view, and this comes back to, I suppose, my background working with the injury schemes and looking at the lifetime care needs, is discounting everything back to what do you need at birth at age 20 in order to fund these costs. And that's why I see this becoming an archetypal actuarial problem. We've got inflows and outflows happening at different stages. We've got long-term projections, lots of moving parts. And I think this is where actuarial methodology can add a lot of value. One way of looking at the problem is using an actuarial runoff triangle. So down each row, we can have the year in which people were born. Each column could represent the payments of the tax revenue, however you wanted to look at it, by their age. And so that would be how an actuary would look at it. The pay-as-you-go approach is just looking at one diagonal, one payment year's worth of experience. And as governments generally do, they're just adding that up as a total. ANU has been able to get to the next level down and do that by age. But again, that's just one year's experience. And the analysis that I've shown up to this point is still mixing different generations. What the actuarial approach would be is to look at what's happening, say, for a given birth year or decade, generation, if you like, is probably more realistic. Say, everyone born in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, this is what your expenditure is looking like. We know, for example, or we hope at least, that people born in more recent generations will have had longer time to save for their retirement through superannuation. So their drain on the public system in the 60s and 70s and early 80s should be less than the current generation. But equally, they're going to probably live a little bit longer. And so they've got a completely different set of characteristics to people who are going through that stage now, who are in their 70s or 80s. Likewise, we could look down each column and see how costs are changing over time and people's demands of government. Some generations demand more from government than other generations. And another example of this could be childcare, which has again been in the press a lot recently. So this current generation, people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, are using childcare services a lot more than generations 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so, again, there's a mismatch between what we're seeing just looking at a pay-as-you-go approach and understanding how different generations have actually utilised government services. And this approach that I'm proposing could help make that picture a little bit clearer. So I think there are many benefits to having a lifetime cost approach, and I think this is really getting to the heart of what a sustainable tax system is. If we are paying, as I said, enough taxes to fund all of our services, then the lifetime cost approach on a net present value basis would be zero. It also means that we can discount any particular policy decision to a single number as a discounted present value and consider how this affects different cohorts differently. So I'll go through an example later on which shows that a policy decision may affect people born today very differently to that same policy decision as it applies to people born 40 or 50 years ago. I think it's also really helpful in understanding the slow burn policy decisions, such as indexing the pension, all of those, or fixing the pension age at a particular point in time, because these things have a very small impact now. But think of the impact on the 20-year-old if pensions increase by 1% more each year for the next 50 years by the time they actually start to access the system. That is a much higher cost over the long term. It also forces us to really consider the tax and welfare systems together. They are just two sides of the same coin, and you really need to consider all your policy decisions in light of the other. Considering just the impact on one, I think, will give us many false reads. Another benefit is that maybe we can start looking at the system with a few new ideas. Some ideas, and I'm just throwing them out there. You know, maybe we have age-based tax incentives. Do we allow working mothers or people who have just had children to have a higher tax-free threshold as an incentive to get them back into the workforce? Or do you have older workers having a higher tax-free threshold as well to encourage them to remain in the workforce if they're able to? Incentives always drive people's behaviours. Or do we need to start measuring the policy impact, as I said, on different generations in more micro detail? So what is the impact of changes in mortality improvements? This is a really uncertain assumption, and I've never seen any government costing work that says if mortality continues to improve at 1% per annum, the impact on this generation will be X. But if we have a lot of medical breakthroughs and it improves by 2 or 3% per annum, the impact would be Y. I've never seen that sort of sensitivity performed in government costings. And the intergenerational report certainly doesn't go into that level of detail, but it's one which actuaries would be well accustomed to. And as I said earlier, we can take into account different characteristics and saving levels, as well as demands of government that different generations have. It is pleasing that change has actually started to happen. We are seeing actuaries and actuarial thinking beginning to infiltrate their way into government thinking. The NDIS, as a newly established system, has a scheme actuary, and although it's still funded on a pay-as-you-go basis, there is an actuary in place to monitor lifetime costs and check its sustainability. In the recent Actuaries Institute Health Green Paper, it was also mentioned that a lifetime costing approach is a good idea, but conceded we're probably too far down the track to actually do something about it, given the state of our ageing population. In New Zealand, the Ministry of Social Development has an actuarial valuation for some of their welfare costs, and they're using this to drive a return on investment approach to see where do they get the biggest bang for their buck in getting people back to work, essentially trying to get the value of getting a younger person back in work and paying taxes is a lot higher than getting someone in their 60s back at work. And this sort of thinking is really progressive, and it can be extended to a number of other areas, including the justice system. How much should we invest to keep someone out of jail as opposed to and get them to become a model citizen, if you like, and start paying taxes? We can start to quantify these numbers. The third problem which I want to touch on is this about reporting and transparency. I think we clearly have a level of underfunding in Australia because we don't have any savings for people who are over 65. It's still funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. And the risk of that is if you just don't look and you're too scared to find out, it doesn't make the problem go away. It just means you're uninformed about the size of the problem. The current system does not articulate wealth transfers or all of the wealth transfers sufficiently for my mind, and we're getting some potentially unintended wealth transfers occurring as a result, as I said, potentially from people born in 1 year transferring wealth unintentionally to people born in another year. And finally, I find the numbers in the way people understand the tax system quite inaccessible, and I'm a fairly numerate person, so I can only imagine what other people are finding in the tax system. People can't comprehend what $30 billion is. They can't comprehend what 2% of GDP looks like. But if we express everything as a dollar amount per person, people can understand what $400,000 or $500,000 is. They're used to numbers of this amount when they're buying a house or getting a loan. They know how hard it is to save this amount of money and to repay it back. And I think if we can distill policy decisions to say, we're going to implement this policy and it's going to cost you on average an extra $5,000 over the course of your life, people can then make it a bit more tangible to them as to what that means. If we were to go down a lifetime funding approach, I think we can start to monitor experience by generation. So this is just a hypothetical example. If we happen to have a lifetime funding approach for many years, we could have a target level of funding for each generation that would be required. We could set a range around that, and then we can measure where we are actually funded at each point in time relative to our target. We could see that some generations are overfunded and some might be underfunded, and that, as long as they're within a range, is not a problem in and of itself, so long as the system balances out. But if every generation was underfunded, that's when we're starting to run into real problems. And it also means that we can have early interventions. If you can see that people, that younger people especially, are severely underfunded, let's start to take decisions now, because they might only be small but could add up to a big amount over time, rather than waiting till they reach age 40, 50 or 60 when it's too late to do anything. So we could see, for example, again, if we were to change the pension system, I'm just going to pick on that one because it's one that's easy to understand. If you were to change the level of the age pension, people who are over 65 and already receiving the pension, they can't contribute more. They haven't had that opportunity. And so the burden is then going to fall onto other generations. And that's not to say that we shouldn't do it. It may very well be a great idea. But at least let's make it clear as to how much money we're transferring between different generations and the impact of some of those policy decisions. So here is another example, and just, I'm not going to go through all of this in detail, it is in the paper. But if we think about the baby bonus as a policy decision, it's one that's relatively new in the life of Australia. And on a pay-as-you-go approach, what we're seeing is that people from all generations who pay tax will contribute to people who are having children, and people of older generations who may be past that stage of their lives, what they're doing is they're paying money, but essentially they're not ever going to receive any direct benefit from this system. That's fine. Under a lifetime approach, what you would see from this is that maybe those older generations are effectively quarantined so that they're not having to pay any additional tax, nor are they receiving any benefit. So their position is neutral. And what we're seeing then is for younger generations, where the shift is that it becomes a bit more circular, that only those generations who are benefiting from that policy should essentially have to fund it. And you could do that by testing sort of how well funded that cohort is using the tools from the previous page. If this policy was going to tip a generation from being well funded to underfunded, maybe then you need to start thinking about either changing the tax rates for those people or how good a policy this is. But we never see that level of analysis when we do look at things on a pay-as-you-go system. So up until this point, it has been quite a theoretical approach, and what I'd like to see is how could we actually implement some change? Now, this is clearly going to be difficult. There's no easy answers, but I think we can take a few small steps to head into the right direction. And it's more along, let's change our mindset about how we do things. We're not going to be able to go from a pay-as-you-go system to a fully funded system in the next 5 years. That's clearly just not possible. But let's change the way we think about the system. So the first thing is Australia needs to really understand its current financial position as a whole. And I don't think we really understand where we're at entirely. If you speak to any financial planner, they'll tell you need to know where you are now in order to figure out what you can achieve and what your goals are, or what if your goals could be achievable in your older age. And Australia hasn't quite had that discussion yet. We don't know where we are. But I do think over the longer term we can actually shift gradually from a pay-as-you-go approach to a fully funded approach. And there are examples where this has been done. So the ACC in New Zealand has actually done this. So they are the Universal Accident Compensation Scheme in New Zealand. And in the 90s, they decided to move from a pay-as-you-go approach to a fully funded approach. So what they did was they said, OK, for all new accidents, so for accidents in the next year, we're going to make sure that our premium covers the lifetime cost of those accidents. But we know that we've still got all the future costs for all the past accidents, which we haven't ever funded. So we're going to work out what that amount needs to be. We're going to put a small residual levy on top of the fully funded premium, and we're going to try and get to a fully funded state for all those tail costs by 2014. And they monitored this experience, and as they went along, they realised 2014 was going to be a little bit ambitious, so they pushed it out to 2019, and my understanding is they're well on track to meet that goal. I think Australia needs to take some lessons from this and take the same approach. So if we were to think on a fully funded basis, and we take a new entrant to the workforce, so a 20-year-old, how much money do they need to put aside now? What policy settings do we need to have, whether it's changing the money coming in or the money going out, so that they can be fully funded by the time they're 65, so that they've saved in the order of $365,000 by the time they get to age 65. Once we've got that, we can actually say, well, what do we need to be at each age? So maybe a 40-year-old needs to have $100,000 saved up, and they'll save another $265,000 over the next 25 years of their working life. Now, that $100,000 shortfall, it's not going to come out. We can't just fund that out of nowhere. We're going to have to apply the same residual levy or tax, if you like, that would be spread over a number of generations to do that. But what we can do is make sure that from this point onwards, their system is fully funded. So I've got some examples of how this may work. If we take the people born prior to 1930, so these are our 85-year-olds and older, currently we expect their payments to be made over the next 20 years, roughly. They're going to have use of the system till they hit 105 or thereabouts. But what we could do is try to fund all of that within the next 6 years. So on top of, so the solid line in this case represents the current payment trajectory, and the dotted line represents their trajectory under fully funded basis. And that would require in the order of an additional $2.5 billion worth of savings to fund their next 20 years worth of payments into six. And we'd build up a fund of about $16.5 billion that could be drawn down over the following 14 years. We could then repeat this process for people born in the 1930s. So we might start once the people born prior to 1930, once their section is fully funded, we move on to the next generation. And in this case, we might decide to fund those costs, which might be in the order of $3.5 to $4 billion over 8 to 10 years, thereabouts. And we can keep applying this process across the different generations. And we end up with this sort of complicated chart. So this is just looking at all the people who are currently aged over 65. And so that if we smoothed it out, if we saved in the order of $4 billion each year for the next 23 years, that money would accumulate interest, which is the next stack, the pink bar, and then we'd have the different drawdowns over time, which is the yellow, the red, and the grey shaded areas for those different generations. And the green line just represents the accumulated balance of the fund. And so $4 billion is a lot of money, especially when we're projecting deficits as far as the eye can see, but it's not insurmountable. It's not $30 or $40 billion a year. It is achievable. And as I said, this is about changing the mindset. And I think that this could be something which is something which could really completely transform the way in which we think about the tax system. So I wanted to leave you with a few key takeaways about how, as actuaries in an actuarial approach, we could improve the sustainability of the tax system and how we look at it. I think, first of all, we can deliver a stronger framework to help better decisions being made. Again, this was a point touched on this morning. If we provide the best information and complete information, it's then up to policy makers to consciously ignore that decision if they want. That's their choice, but at least we can help them make the best decisions as possible. Secondly, we always need to consider the tax and welfare systems together. I think this is starting to happen. We've heard a lot about that, particularly with the impact of changing superannuation tax rates, that, you know, when you do change the tax rate, it's going to have an impact on the amount of pension costs. And that debate has again started to happen. Thirdly, I think multiple funding pools can increase the accountability and change to some degree the psychology of how we think about the tax system, and that a lifetime approach is really essential to assess the sustainability of the tax system, particularly in relation to benefits that are paid to individuals, so that people can see, right, I'm paying this amount in tax, this is how much we expect as a generation to require in services. And that this will provide us enhanced assessment of all the wealth transfers that are actually occurring. Again, just about transparency in the system, so that people understand where there are cross-subsidies, where wealth is being transferred from one entity to another. And finally, I think Australia is not really fully informed about where we sit from a financial position. And an actuarial approach, it can't fix the system, but it can give us a clearer picture of where we're at, and that this will help drive better outcomes and better decisions. So at the start of this presentation, I did pose the question, over the course of their life, does the average Australian pay enough tax to cover the services they receive from government? While I can't be definitive, I think the answer is almost certainly not. We're not taking into account increasing life expectancies. We're not taking into account the fact that medical treatment costs increase faster than inflation, and all of these factors, and therefore not drawn back into the tax rates that people are paying as individuals. The answer may also vary by generation, because different generations will have different demands on government, and they will also, through skill or luck, stumbled onto periods of higher economic prosperity than other generations. But really what it comes down to is that a lot more work needs to be done in this space. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg, and that we can add a lot of value in really trying to understand the position of Australia's finances and how to make it more sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you, Darryl. I must say I agree. I think I agree with all of that. Whilst I'm going to have to pay more tax, I'm very happy with the idea of understanding where it goes, where it comes from, and who pays. It's quite interesting because I haven't given it enough thought, and your presentation clearly highlights that I hadn't. But the idea of putting back, well, how much are we paying and what do we get, and how does it go across generations, and this whole pay-as-you-go basis, I think, is, we operate in a naive environment in terms of tax, but I think you've articulated that particularly well, so thank you. And you pointed out New Zealand's investment approach to their welfare, and Australia's put away a budget to look at that. But it's interesting, we've only put away a budget to look at it in terms of particular aspects of the taxes that we spend. We haven't put away to look at our whole tax system. We do have a few minutes for a couple of questions or comments, so please, if anyone's got any questions, Richard.
Richard Lyon. That was fabulous.
Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. I had intended to read the paper. I haven't read the paper. I will read the paper. I will study the slides, and I may well do a bit more than that. One of the things that j- jumps to my mind is that actually that's the way that people think about their tax. When they retire and they take the pension, they talk about the fact that they have paid their taxes all their lives. They're now entitled to the benefits. So while it might not be the way the government thinks about things, it certainly is a way that resonates with the individual. I do want to pick you up on one little thing which is really annoying about the tax debate at the moment. You happened to mention company tax and how high it was, and you automatically therefore, I think, include dividend imputation as part of company tax rather than as a withholding tax on behalf of individuals. And when you're going through this exercise, it's going to be very, very important what box things belong in. And some of the debates will get very, very heated around those boxes. But thank you very much for the paper.
Anthony Claudin, KPMG. Firstly, just also really enjoyed it. Two things, one a comment and one a question. I suspect, like a lot of people here, I found the 23% extra taxes to actually fund ourselves very, very high and a little bit scary. Did that allow for mortality, or was that assuming someone lived through that whole period?
No, that allowed for mortality, and and I did include mortality improvement as well, so I do think that that is something that we need to consider. But I would say, and it gets back to the point, a lot more work needs to be done here. So those numbers are, you know, could change quite significantly as you did more and more analysis, but the publicly available information is quite limited.
Yeah. The second part, which was a comment, is just on the first part where splitting into pools to look at connecting taxes with what's driving costs. Although I'm not against that idea, because I especially think it's a good idea to maybe split it into things like infrastructure in such a way you might use more debt rather than tax, it is an interesting one from a political point of view, because there's a likelihood that people who have an ideological push for or against one aspect of where we're paying the money out, whether that's benefits or things like defence on the other side, could use that as a way of cutting or increasing one or the other a little bit more slyly than they can at the moment when it's all put together.
Yep, fair enough.
Andrea Glass, did you look retrospectively at all, when you're talking about the different generations, at what different benefits different tranches had received on their way through? For example, those that got the free university education and those who have had student loans and basically paid for their own. And do you think that's something that needs to be brought into the analysis?
Absolutely. I think it needs to be brought in, and that's why I did recommend sort of the runoff triangle approach. So you can see that different generations would have utilised education differently, and that needs to factor into the mix. But unfortunately, it wasn't particularly easy to get the whole history, and it was really challenging even to get 1 year's worth of data broken down.
Jeff Rashbrook, and just following up with the New Zealanders since you mentioned us. I think it's a fantastic paper, but it's like that joke about lawyers buried in their heads up to sand. What have you got? A good start. But you've still got a lot of long way to go. Well, I thought it was brilliant, and want to talk to Andrea about it afterwards, how we might try and publicise that sort of thing in New Zealand. But the thing you need to know about ACC is it had a brilliant investment manager. It had a guy from a, you know, the family, and he works for about 10% or less than somebody of his skill would get in the market. So you do have, in this approach, you do have investment risk, significant investment risk, and you have to work out how you're going to manage that. Demographics, you didn't mention, but that's one of the things that turns the whole thing out, not just longevity, but the actual demographics. You've got political risk because we have a pre-funding scheme for super, which the government decided it didn't want to subscribe to. It wanted to reduce revenue, so that's always a risk. And the final thing is the more you can fit it into a market framework, the more you're going to get governments to listen to it. Governments these days operate very much in a market social market framework. So something that's a little academic like this is going to have a lot of trouble getting traction. So I haven't been able to think of it, or anybody else working at it. If you could actually think of some way of framing that in that way, then I'm sure that this superb approach might actually get somewhere.
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on just a response to that. In the paper, I did go into a lot of those risks, but I knew that I would be a bit pressed for time. So I think that investment risk is important. And, you know, if you did build up a fund, you know, governments are very good at seizing that money when it suits their political needs. Absolutely.
Thank you, Daryl. I'm sure all of us have really enjoyed Daryl's presentation, and I think most of us now, because we haven't done so, we are going to go and read the paper. And it's great to actually see that a paper has been produced. So thank you, Daryl, and please join me in congratulating Daryl.